Hello, rock and roll rebels, and welcome to another episode of Ramble On with Rosie. We are here to discuss one of the greatest albums of all time. And I know that phrase can get applied to a lot of albums, but when it comes to this particular album, there's no denying that it kinda lives up to the hype. It was released on November 8th, 1971, which means it's having its 50th birthday this week. And it is an album with many names and no title. We are talking about Led Zeppelin's Untitled album, commonly known as Led Zeppelin IV, though sometimes called Zozo, or The Four Symbols, or just The Symbols album, or Symbols, or I call it The Lord of the Rings album, because there's a few Tolkien-related songs on it. If you've ever wondered why it doesn't have a title, it was to basically get back at the critics who were calling Led Zeppelin a hype band. They were like, oh, you know, they're not that good. They're not actually musically talented. I'm like, say what? They have one of the top three guitar players and one of the top three drummers in this band, so the critics are wrong. But, and obviously Led Zeppelin knew the critics were wrong. So to combat this false accusations of being hype, they released an album that didn't even have the band name on the outside. There's nothing on the outside of this album. Other than a stark, sort of blurred urban scene with a painting of an old man carrying some sticks superimposed on top of it. The painting came from a thrift store when Jimmy Page and Robert Plant were out junk shopping, because Jimmy Page liked to junk shop and acquire furniture and art, and Robert Plant found the painting and thought they should work it in onto their album art, and so they did. And they figured it sort of captured, you know, between that and the stark urban scene that it's imposed on top of, they figured that sort of captured their modernness, but also their love of the old ways. So that's the exterior of the album, which is pretty stark, pretty muted colors, you know, it's intriguing, but it's not exciting. The inside gets a little bit more colorful, or at least a little bit more bold. You have the painting of the hermit from tarot card lore by Jimmy Page's friend Barrington Colby. So he painted the hermit for the album. And they chose the hermit because they sort of felt that they both represented the seeker who's going to the hermit, seeking the truth, as well as the hermit as a giver of light, because their music is very lightning. In fact, according to Jimmy Page, they lightened the energy at Headley Grange, where they recorded this album, by being there and making music and joyful noise when it had a really unpleasant, bleak past, which we'll get to the history of Headley Grange in a minute. Right now we're talking about the exteriors of the album. So we have the gatefold and the actual outside of the jacket, and if you open it where the record is, there is an insert, and that's where you get the band credits. So if you lost that, you'd have no idea who did this album unless you looked at the actual vinyl, thus proving, you know, they're not a hype band. Which anybody who knows anything knows Led Zeppelin wasn't a hype band. They're every bit as good as they're reported to be, but they had a point to prove with the critics, even though the record company told them they were committing professional suicide by doing this. And on that insert, you have, on one side, the lyrics to Stairway to Heaven are printed out in a typeface that Jimmy found in an old, like, magazine from the 1800s that he had a friend of his, like, recreate a whole alphabet for. And so that's the lyrics to Stairway to Heaven on one side. On the other side, you get the famed four symbols, except that there's actually five. We'll get to that. The first of these I'm going to discuss, because I tried to research these and find out as much as I could. Obviously, some of these symbols are really old, and so it's hard to know anything for absolutely for sure. But from what I could find out, I have a brief history of each of them. So Robert Plant's, which is the feather inside of the circle, is associated both with the Egyptian goddess of justice called Maat. That's where the feather is strongly associated. And it's also, of course, an emblem for writers because, you know, feather quills. The origin of that sigil, however, goes all the way back about 15,000 years, actually, to the legendary civilization of Mu, spelled M-U. Who are supposedly the people who were responsible for building the big statues at Easter Island. They're kind of like the people of Atlantis. It's one of those lost empires that nobody really knows what happened to. And they supposedly made the big statues at Easter Island. That's where this, one of the early uses of this symbol comes from. Now, with John Baum, his are a little bit more easy to understand. There's the Bar they're called the Borromean Rings, and they come from the 1933 Book of Signs, which shares that they were used as an early sign for the Trinity, but also, and more importantly, they were used as a representation, the three rings to represent man, woman, and child, which is something very in character for John Bonham because he was very much a family man. And that particular reason being the reason John picked them was actually confirmed by John's son, Jason Bonham. Now, with John Paul Jones, there's three triquetra and a circle, which also makes it kind of related to the Trinity because the triquetra are often used in Christian imagery to represent the Trinity, but they predate that with uses by the Celts. It comes from the same 1933 book that John Bonham's does, and it also appears on the cover of this book for a religious cult from Russia known as the Rosicrucians, and it was the book cover on one of their, texts relating to their cult. And it's also been used as a symbol for a confident and capable person, which definitely fits John Paul Jones. In ancient times, it was also used as a symbol for exorcism, which I don't put anything by there being a curse on Led Zeppelin, but if there was, maybe a symbol of exorcism helped John Paul Jones escape it, because everybody else on this album, including Sandy and Annie, suffered some horrible tragedy in the next 10 years. John Paul Jones is the only one who kind of escaped that. So I don't know if there's anything to it, but maybe his choice in sigil helped him out. Speaking of Sandy Denny, hers also comes from that same 1933 book and also has ties to being used as a representation for the Trinity. It was considered a symbol for the Godhead, and there really wasn't much more on hers. Probably you could find out more if somebody researched it more, but nobody's going to research it as much as they are going to do the four core actual band members. Now, getting to last but not least, and the most murky of them all, and also the most famous, Jimmy Page's Zozo Sigil, which Zozo is not actually a word. That's just what the symbol looks like. It's not supposed to be a word. The nearest resemblance to it can be found in a book from 1557, so, over 400 years before this album's being recorded. And it's used to represent the planet Saturn, which ties in very much with a lot of Jimmy Page's other stuff because he's a Capricorn and that's his ruling planet, and he'll pull in references to his, zodiac sign on his dragon suit, and even on the embroidered on the leg of the white poppy suit, you have the symbol for Capricorn, which looks like 69, and I'm sure he got a kick out of that. And that's embroidered on the pants leg of his white poppy suit as well. So that seems the most plausible. There's other theories that it's supposedly used to re in some texts to represent Satan. And there's also another theory that it's related to this word called sozo, which is used in the Bible. But those seem a little less likely than it coming from this book from 1557, because after all, Jimmy Page did own a bookstore for a while that specialized in books on the occult, some of which were really old. So he might have come across this at some point there. Seems kind of reasonable and less out there. Now, he once explained what it meant to Robert Plant, but gosh darn it, Robert Plant forgot. So here he is, he could have solved the mystery for us. But apparently, too much beer and, weed has taken its toll, and Robert can't remember what Jimmy told him. And I think Jimmy likes keeping us in the dark. He gives it the air of mystery and aloofness that, he seems to like to shroud himself in at times. So That's all we've got on the famed Zozo Sigil. Now, moving on from there to Headley Grange, where this album was recorded. Headley Grange was originally built in 1795 as a workhouse. Now, I had to go double check what a workhouse was, so I knew that it meant what I thought it meant, and it does. It's basically where anybody who was like poor and unemployed would be lodged and fed and put to really menial drudgery. So they were basically doing what in modern times we usually have like our migrant labor do. So like the really hard menial jobs that nobody wants to do. They were like breaking up stones, you know, crushing lime for fertilizer, making the oakum that they tarred ships with. Just the hard labor that nobody wanted to do. The workhouses did sort of eventually transform into also homes for the infirm and the orphans, but they still weren't great places to be. They were so unpleasant that at Headley Grange in 1830, the workers rioted, unsuccessfully albeit, but it still continued to be a workhouse for another 40 years until 1870. 2 years after that, the guy who bought it and had turned it into a private residence sold it again. So it's the ultimate fixer-upper. Buy a workhouse, turn it into a private residence, give it a fancy name like Headley Grange, and sell it. Or maybe he did it because of the supposedly spooky haunting there. Who knows? But it only changed hand a couple more times before the 1960s, where the widow of that owner started renting it out to be used as a hostel for travelers, usually from America, and art students at the nearby Farnham Art School. I'm not sure who was the first person to use it as a recording studio. I thought Fleetwood Mac did before Led Zeppelin, but I couldn't find any evidence of that. So, to my knowledge, Led Zeppelin may have been the first band to use it as a recording studio. Certainly the ones most strongly associated with it between recording the Untitled album here and later that monster double album called Physical Graffiti. So they have the strongest legacy, and it's currently back to being a private house. Though, according to Paige, like I said, it's got a lighter energy for having been so maybe it's a little less gloomy. At the very least, if you're the lucky person who lives there, you can be like, Led Zeppelin recorded their most famous album in my house, and that alone would make it a lighter place to live. If you want to see what the house looks like, you can go to YouTube and check out both some more recent video footage from when Jimmy Page was there during the It Might Get Loud documentary with him and Jack White and The Edge, or you can also check out YouTube and see some home video from the era shot by John Bonham when they were recording there, and you can see the outside of the house, and you can also see Jimmy Page playing mandolin and Robert bouncing up and down and the stray dogs, which we'll get to the stray dogs, because one of those stray dogs was black and followed Robert Plant everywhere he went. He decided Robert Plant was his human, which is pretty great because I think Robert Plant is like to dogs what Freddie Mercury is to cats. He's like, every cat's favorite rock star is probably Freddie Mercury, and every dog, I think, loves Robert Plant. Certainly all the black ones do, because Black Dog was named after that stray that wouldn't stop following Robert. Because there's definitely no mention of black dogs in the lyrics to Black Dog. And that is the first track on the album, which it was inspired loosely by the call and response in Fleetwood Mac's Oh Well. And if you listen to like the almost 9 minute rehearsal jam version that's on YouTube, you can hear that in Plant's early vocals, kind of. You can also hear John Paul Jones invent that ever famous riff from Black Dog, because he plays it on his bass and then Jimmy, you know, recreates it on his electric guitar. And just check out that rehearsal version. It's really good. It sort of gives you a lot of insight into the, you know, formation of the song. And to me, the pacing of that rehearsal version almost has like a tinge of New Orleans funeral music to it, which I really enjoy and appreciate. Now, however, the guitars that you hear there and that were recorded later at Headley Grange are not the ones you hear on the album track. A lot of the guitars had to be recorded at Island Studios because while Headley Grange was great for drum acoustics, it wasn't always the best for a good guitar sound. Now, song number two on the Untitled album is Good Ol' Rock and Roll, which was inspired out of a jam because they had been working on Four Sticks and had kind of gotten stuck. And so John Bonham starts doing the riff from the beginning of Little Richard's Keep a Knockin' on his drum set, and Jimmy picks it up on his guitar, and they just jam on that until it becomes rock and roll. And then at Island Studios, they add on piano, but it's not Jean-Paul Jones playing it, it's Ian Stewart, who had been with the Rolling Stones, and who, according to Jimmy Page, is like a master of the boogie-woogie style of piano, which is exactly what they needed for the track. So they have a non-Led Zeppelin member playing piano on that particular track. Next up, you have one of the Lord of the Rings songs, which is Battle of Evermore, which has like a lot of imagery, and it's just really big and massive and epic, and to me it feels like you're standing on top of a hill or a big mountain in the mist watching some epic battle go on below you. It's like you're watching either, the Battle of Pelennor Fields out of Lord of the Rings, or like in the prehistory to Lord of the Rings, you're watching the battle where, Sauron gets defeated. But there's also some deeper philosophical stuff to it. It's not just really cool poetic imagery. There's some philosophical questions like the statement of the pain of war cannot exceed the woe of aftermath. That's a pretty deep observation on the ravages of war to sort of mull over for a little bit. It also features like the only time somebody outside of the four members of Led Zeppelin sings vocals, because Sandy Denny of the British folk band Fairport Convention adds that lovely haunting vocal, accents and flourishes, which is just really, makes the song. Like, it takes it from being a decent song to, like, next level. Now, granted, Battle of Evermore is one of those Led Zeppelin songs that you might have to listen to a few times in order to really appreciate. It's not gonna, like, probably be your favorite the first time you listen to this album, but it's still a really good song. Now, next up, we have the mammoth 8-minute masterpiece that needs no introduction. A song that by the time it reached its 20th anniversary had been played for a cumulative 43 years. So if you took its 8 minutes and multiplied it by the time it was, how many times it had been played on the radio, and divided that by how many minutes there are in a year and did the math, it's a little over 43 years of airplay. And that's only, that's 30 years ago now. So Stairway to Heaven is just an indisputable epic. It's one of those songs that even if you think it's overplayed or overhyped, you kind of still acknowledge its greatness. Like, it may not be your favorite, but it's indisputably great. And it's also interesting for the fact that it has Jimmy Page uses all of his main guitars except for the Danelectro on it. So he uses his Harmony acoustic, he uses the Gibson, he uses the Telecaster, he uses his 12 string. The only one he doesn't use is the Danelectro, and he doesn't use the big iconic double neck because he didn't have it yet. He bought that, had the guitar custom made by Gibson for the sole purpose of being able to play Stairway to Heaven with it. He also contemplated ruining it once. There were some security that were being very rough with fans in the front row, and to quote Jimmy Page, he sort of like, had the guitar I'd been playing not been literally irreplaceable, I would have smashed it over their head. And I'm like, there's only one guitar that could be, because it took at that time 18 months for Gibson to make that monstrosity, and so he'd have had to gone 18 months of touring without being able to play Stairway to Heaven, which was not gonna be something he was willing to do. Now, next up is the Misty Mountain Hop, which has Tolkien in the title, but the lyrics have nothing to do with Tolkien, unless you accept the theory that hobbits are stoners. because the lyrics are about a July 1968 rally to legalize pot that was held in Hyde Park in London. So, unless you think that the Hobbits are stoners, that there's not much relation between the title and the lyrics, kind of like Black Dog. And Misty Mountain Hop would go to be the B-side of the album's first single, which is Black Dog. And the next song took them a while to get down right. Four Sticks. They kept trying to record it at Headley Grange and it wasn't working out. And so when they were at Ireland recording, Bonham came in after seeing Ginger Baker's band Air Force the night before. And of course, there being somewhat of a rivalry between Ginger Baker and John Bonham, he declared, "I'll show Ginger Baker something," and seized two drumsticks in each hand and proceeded to play the song with four sticks, hence its title. And so, four sticks is basically four sticks and one middle finger to Ginger Baker. It would be the B-side to Rock and Roll, which is funny because, like I mentioned earlier, Rock and Roll was the song that was birthed out of a jam session after they got stumped trying to record Four Sticks at Headley Grange. Now, the next song is on the album is Going to California, which originally was called A Guide to California. And it may have been a little bit too accurate of a guide because when Jimmy Page arrived in Los Angeles to mix the album at Sunset Studios, he was greeted by an earthquake. Like, he was sitting in bed and, and he decided wisely that he should probably mix Going to California last. And if you listen to it in live versions, it seems to be the song was somewhat inspired by Joni Mitchell, because Robert Plant will sing, "Hey Joni" in it at times, which is interesting because when he had written it, they had not met yet. But they admired her artistically. So this proves two major songs that were inspired by Joni Mitchell, the other one being Graham Nash's song Our House, which was a little bit more than just an artistic admiration on Graham Nash's part, given he was living with her at the time. So, Joni Mitchell is supposed to be the girl with flowers in her hair in Going to California. And so we've come to the final track, which this is the track that made me fall in love with Led Zeppelin. It is such a sound. We're talking about When the Levee Breaks, which is a cover of a Memphis Minnie song that she wrote about the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. She actually survived this. She was at like her brother-in-law's house. I think it was in Wall, Mississippi, when the levee broke. So that situation inspired the song, and the song is just a masterpiece. Part of that has to do with the very unique drum sound, which came from John Bonham had ordered a new drum kit, and so his drum tech had set it up in the entrance hall at Headley Grange. And so Bonzo went in there and started playing on his new toy, and suddenly everybody's like, "Whoa, we love what you're doing. We're gonna record your drums in here." So they had some mics up in the stairwell, which is why it just has that big sound. And part of me wonders, knowing what I've learned from reading Stephen Van Zandt's autobiography about what they were doing in studios in the 70s, part of me wonders if that isn't why Led Zeppelin was so often recording on location, because apparently in the 70s there was this big trend by the engineers at recording studios to pad the heck out of everything and just stifle any ambient, atmospheric sound and like add that back in the mix rather than just let it organically happen. So maybe that's why Led Zeppelin was recording at Headley Grange in the first place. At the very least, the drum sound on When the Levee Beats could When the Levee Breaks could not be replicated to the epicness that it is at a studio. So, very glad they were recording on location there. They also slowed down the track, which gives it part of that like chugging, eerie, mournful blues sound, which in combination with the lyrics almost makes you feel like you're watching, the river just float away all of your earthly possessions and you're just, depressed and sad. Like, I love When the Levee Breaks so much. Part of that has to do with Robert Plant's very plaintive harmonica playing, which was added in at the mix. And that's a mix that nearly didn't make it. We might have had a very different sounding When the Levee Breaks had Jimmy Page not looked into something he thought was ruined. So backstory there is he did the mix in Los Angeles, where he had the earthquake at Sunset Studios, and then took it back to England, and they're not sure why. There's some theory that it either was like the monitors at Sunset Studios weren't giving a good reading of what they were actually mixing, or it may have been the magnets that supposedly were being used on the British subway system, the Underground, were messed with the tape. Because when he played it back for the band, everybody was astonished because, like, the treble was basically missing. So it sounded really muddy and not worth handing to the record company at all, obviously. So, that being known, they're like, okay, what do we do here? And so Jimmy Page remixed all the songs again, and he was trying to get the mix for When the Levee Breaks right to sound like he'd had it in Los Angeles at Sunset Sound Studios. And so he went and decided to revisit that mix. Unfortunately, that one was still intact. So, it was the only version out of those Los Angeles mixes that made it on the album. So it'd be, interesting to know what it had sounded like in the other mixes. I think, I'm not entirely sure, but I think the mix for Stairway to Heaven may have survived as well, though it's not what made it on the album. But if you have the deluxe edition of the Untitled album by Led Zeppelin, you can find the Sunset Sound mix there, and it sounds pretty good. I like it. I almost like it better than the version on the album. But those two songs make the album, whichever version you're listening to of Stairway to Heaven. They're both, like, to me, they're just the epic pieces. They both close out each side of the album, and they clinch this album's place in history as just a monumental masterpiece that will never be topped. I mean, according to Jimmy Page, if he was approached by an alien and asked to hand over, like, an album, the Untitled album is the album that he's handing to the aliens. And I'm not sure if that's to represent just his work as an artist or, like, humanity's overall artistic output in the realm of music. Either way, it's still a good pick. Like, I'd be hard pressed to, come up with a better option. I'm not sure if it's the one I'd pick, but I couldn't, complain if that's what somebody picked to hand the aliens. My pick would probably be Born to Run, because, I'm not sure if I want the aliens getting inspiration from Battle of Evermore and sending a Ringwraith after us. Born to Run seems like a better snapshot of humanity in the lyrics, but musically, you cannot top the incredible Untitled fourth album by Led Zeppelin. And, like I said, Stairway to Heaven may be considered overplayed, but it lives up to the hype. You can't really argue that it deserves its spot at the number one, rock song where it frequently finds itself. It's usually in the top three. I know that whenever SiriusXM does, like, their, top songs and people vote, Stairway to Heaven's usually number one. So, on that note, y'all should definitely go listen to the birthday album this week. It's turning 50 years old, and it is a phenomenal piece. And enjoy your week. Jam out, rock on, listen to it multiple times. And I will be back next week. And in the meantime, y'all have a great week. Be kind to each other and rock on.